Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You
good people. Okay, welcome listeners to Fortress on a Hill. We decided that it was really important that we take this moment. Oddly enough, that just a few hours ago, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th president of the United States. So we wanted to take today to talk about our predictions and possibilities for 2021. So we're going to take a jaunt around the globe to a bunch of different regions, and we're going to pepper Danny. Because we never do that. We never rely on Danny for his expertise. Danny has a really great Tom Dispatch piece coming out on this topic. It actually comes out tomorrow. And we're going to do a... I'm going to do a super fast turnaround with editing and stuff. So this episode should be available for all of you to hear tomorrow, the 21st of January. And as you're listening today, if you see any... You know, if you... see anything that we missed or that needs to be pointed out more, please let us know. Tell us what your thoughts and predictions are for this year. We absolutely want to hear them. Danny, do you want to take a minute and talk a little bit about your piece?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Tom Dispatch is, of course, we've had Tom on, and we've actually had a number of different Tom Dispatch regulars on, like Bill Astori writes over there, Andrew Basevich, who we haven't had, but he writes over there, and, you know, Eric Edstrom has, but Rebecca Gordon, of course. When you do an article for Tom, I mean, it's a different kind of place. It gets like a pretty decent amount of syndication in the mid and upper mid media, including some worldwide stuff. And Tom is different also in that he likes long form pieces that are like 2,500 words. And he's kind of a brutal editor in like the old school fashion. But he also kind of helps pick a topic with you. You know, you have like, and he's old school, right? He's like 74 years old and he like does things like the old correct way sort of. And so you talk on the phone and you go back and forth and you brainstorm. So when he said he wanted me to do one of the early, you know, articles, something that was going to be timed on the inauguration, essentially, you know, he said, how about, you know, something that relates to what we can expect from Biden. And I had actually been working on, and I'm still working on, like a broader piece on basically an around the globe flyover of like every region and making predictions a bit for what might happen there. Because I've been right a lot recently, but that's disturbing. Like, I'm not as vindicated by that as I want, like whether it was Nagorno-Karabakh or certain Biden picks. And now it seems my stuff on West Africa, you know, I've been right a bunch, and don't worry, it won't hold. And if it does, we're going extinct as a species. So like, root against me, guys. I'm like Pete Rose. I'm going to be like betting against my own team because that's best for everyone. But he said, okay, well, like, I don't know that I want you to do that specifically, but let's talk, you know, what's Biden going to do in some key regions? And that's kind of what the piece does. It doesn't hit everywhere, but it hits the general highlights, mostly regional and then just a little bit thematic.
All right. So first up, we're going to go take a quick jaunt through the greater Middle East, talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, certainly Syria and Yemen. For my part, I was making some notes this morning about pretty much all those places, but more specifically Yemen, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So right now in Afghanistan, Trump has us down to 2,500 troops, and there is a deal coming to remove all U.S. troops in the next few months that was signed. There's still about 18,000 contractors that are there for those 2,500 troops, although about 4,700 of those are local Afghans. And my guess, my thought about it is that the drawdown is going to probably get reversed, which is a shame because it's certainly been one of Trump's better calls on the foreign policy stage to attempt to bring troops down there. It was even got so serious last summer that the Congress withheld funds specifically for Trump to not withdraw the troops, actually took the money away that could have potentially made that happen. So Danny, what do you think Biden will do with this, especially considering that there is an actual peace deal that has been agreed upon and that there's an actual timetable for that deal?
Yeah, you know, Afghanistan specifically, I'm of two minds about, and I'll get that in a second. I think that a good general prediction that I've, you know, been saying for a while in a bunch of places is that I don't think that we're going to see Biden do, you know, Iraq war, whatever it would be by this point, 3 or 4.0. I don't think we're going to see like a big invasion followed by catastrophic sectarian civil war set off by our own troops, at least proxies, maybe. I think partly mainly because there's no political will for it. And Biden, if nothing else, has shown himself to be the type that is malleable and kind of shifts with the prevailing political winds, which we've talked about when we talked about his general foreign policy. But also, I think I like to believe he kind of has learned something, you know, from the Bush years of like the post 9/11 era. So I think in general, we're going to see is like a lot of the same, like a very low intensity war as abstraction. This will be across the greater Middle East and Africa. You know, this general use of proxies, contractors, drones, commando raids, and like security force assistance, you know, like that's how we're going to fight the war. It'll be low intensity for America, not always low intensity for its victims and its second and third order consequences. Now, Afghanistan is just, I'm very much of two minds about it because Biden was basically the best in the senior levels of the Obama administration when he was vice president on Afghanistan. You know, I've mentioned before that it's in Richard Holbrooke's, you know, death diary, you know, I mean, that they had a conversation where Biden like snapped at him and is like, it won't work. Like, we're not going to be able to transform the society. I'm not sending my son 10,000 miles around the world to go back there. Of course, he hadn't been in Afghanistan, been in Iraq, but, you know, back to these wars, back to the war in Afghanistan specifically to, you know, fight for women's rights. It won't work. It won't work, he said. And he was a critic of it. I mean, and in general, he's been more of the, hey, let's do counter terror rather than counterinsurgency, you know, lower impact on America. That being said, everything that we're hearing from like the Jake Sullivans, his incoming national security advisor of the world, everything that's in their past record, and everything that we have seen in Biden's record, which is like a classic hedging. You know, I think that's what I said at the end of the piece was like, when it comes to Afghanistan, you know, because Trump didn't pull enough troops out faintly fast enough, thereby making the withdrawal maybe irreversible, expect a trademark Biden hedge here. And I think that that's true in a lot of places, but it's particularly true in Afghanistan. So a lot of the statements from Jake Sullivan stuff is like, we won't have any more combat troops or American troops in combat or in harm's way, but not the statement of everyone will be gone by X date. I don't think we'll see any of that. There could be a reversal. It could jump from 2,500 back to 4,000 or something like that. We could even see like a mini surge of like logistics, special forces, and, you know, air power if the Taliban starts to gain ground. My last point on this that worries me, two last points. One, the Democratic Party. I'm afraid of the Democratic Party more than I'm specifically afraid of Joe Biden on this issue, because I really do think that he was almost like a consensus collection of like smoke-filled rooms, like backroom insiders in the DNC. Like, and I don't know, you know, presidents have a lot of unilateral power, but he's going to feel pressure from his own party. And they are, they've kind of followed the whole, if Trump did it, we have to do the opposite, which of course they learned from Trump, who did that about Obama. If Obama was for it, I'm against it, and vice versa. So voting against, you know, the appropriations needed to pull the troops is a worrying signal. Now, one would hope that when Biden's in charge, troop withdrawals could be celebrated by the same Democrats, because most of them don't really believe in anything. Right. Let's be clear. And that's, you know, I'm not even talking about the Republicans because, you know, they're dead to me. But this is, I think, especially after, you know, only 10 of them voted for impeachment or whatever in the House. But I that worries me. And then the final bit is there are interested parties at think tanks funded by the war industry at places like West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, at other, you know, kind of defense analyst organizations like RAND. You're seeing a lot of alarmism come back, and I'll get to it in Africa later. You're seeing it in Afghanistan too. All this reporting saying, oh, there's a renewed connection between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and they're going to bring back the safe haven myth, this idea that, you know, terrorism is way worse if they have like a safe haven that they can kind of stay in a cave or whatever. Of course, that's all been like deflated time and again. But I'm afraid that he'll be susceptible to that kind of logic and will be afraid that if he pulls everybody out and then something does go wrong and there is an attack or whatever in America, or if something obscene happens, like some sort of mass beheading of like adulterous women, alleged adulterous women in a stadium again in Afghanistan, that he'll be criticized as cutting and running. So that's why I expect a hedge. And it worries me because, you know, if Biden doesn't pull them out during his tenure, we are actually, and realistically, this could happen, staring down the barrel of, you know, 24 years of Afghan war. I mean, that's beyond absurd.
So let's move on to Iraq for a minute. We are about just over a year from the most recent major demonstrations in Iraq. Also, just right around a year from the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, which was a big blow to our connections, not only with Iran, but with Iraq. Going back to the protests for a moment, you know, the Iraqis protesting corruption in their government, violence against protesters, low wages, basic services from the government. And then you have a country that, moving back from the protests a little bit, that has been absolutely destroyed by ISIS, by their invasion of it, that, you know, places like Mosul in the north and Anbar province in the west, basically, I mean, they exist, but they're rubble with bodies everywhere. And, you know, we the ISIS invasion was preempted by America's own withdrawal of a majority of their forces, and they only ended up that the majority of forces that guys like I, like me, and also like BT trained, ran. They sold their weapons or left them behind for other parties to do with as they seemed. But now that ISIS has been pushed down significantly, it's important to note that Iraqis did most of the heavy lifting during that time. But in country, there are still more than a million unsettled refugees, people who cannot return to their homes, probably because they're completely bombed out. Of course, they're dealing with COVID, which is hard for any country to deal with, but especially hard because of our sanctions and destroyed infrastructure. So, you know, my only thought about it in terms of moving forward, you know, I think that Iraq should be given all the money and supplies it needs to rebuild their country. But as America, our country has never made that a priority. My guess is that Biden will help that situation more than Trump, but much like you mentioned, Danny, about him hedging, I don't expect much more than beyond that, that the billions and billions that should go to a country that our military destroyed probably won't get the help that they need.
You know, when the Iraq Veterans Against the War were founded, in what, 2004, you know, I was talking to Kelly Daugherty recently, who was one of the co-founders, and, you know, one of their original platforms was, you know, not just like troops home, but reparations for the Iraqi people, you know. I mean, that look, no one's even considering reparations for chattel slavery in the United States, right? And then, like, you know, the century of Jim Crow and then de facto Jim Crow that goes on today. Certainly there's no talk of reparations for Iraq. What we see instead is this just like a continued infusion of defense money, right? Of military money, of military training and weapons and these sorts of things. My take on Iraq, what worries me about Iraq is Iraq matters because humans live there and because it's an important country. But from an American strategic perspective and what concerns me in terms of the decisions that are being made, okay, and I don't mean sound obtuse, I will say this. Iraq doesn't matter that much any longer, except insofar as it worsens, it only stands to worsen our relations with Iran and the possibility of a war there. What you have in Iraq is American soldiers who literally do not know what they're doing there, right? They, I mean, could an American soldier really explain what their purpose is in Iraq, right? They say it's like Syria. They say it originally, well, we're here to fight ISIS as part of the ISIS coalition. But if you actually listen to what the generals and the analysts and the national security officials on the civilian side say, it's always the same thing. It's like, no, we're actually here to balance Russia and Iran in Syria and Iran in Iraq. We're there as part of a proxy war, and we've made ourselves our own proxies in our own proxy war. And we've thrown these guys into these bases and turned them into rocket magnets for vaguely Iranian inflected and sometimes more so Iraqi militias to shoot rockets at whenever we do something new and aggressive and obscene at Iran, or whenever Iran needs to shore up its hardliner credentials with, you know, certain elements of their public, especially when their economy is flailing and they're doing bad with COVID, right? And so they're there, they're magnets, they're rocket magnets. And the problem is the toughness dilemma, the Democrats' dilemma of toughness. They must always, they feel, seem extra tough because they're afraid the Republicans will swift boat them. And I say this all the time, right? John Kerry, when they swift boated and tried to say he was like a coward and he wasn't a good soldier, even though he was like highly decorated as a Navy swift boat captain. So, but they'll get a swift boat you anyway, the Republicans, but they're so afraid of it that we like hedge and we always tack right. And they always move the goalposts, the Republicans do. So I'm afraid that if Americans die under Biden's watch in Iraq, in one of these, you know, barrages of missiles, like if a, you know, if an unlucky hit hits an unlucky soldier who chose the unlucky porta potty, and it's funny, but it's not, because it really happens, as you know, as we know, that Biden will feel obliged to respond to Iran. So, you know, I cannot see a situation where, you know, our presence in Iraq is anything but destabilizing and anything but increasing the likelihood that a more dangerous conflict with Iran, whether it be proxy or in some cases genuine, like bombing or then Iran unleashing some of its folks on us across the region, right? Because we have lots of targets in the Middle East, including floating targets. That all worries me. And so I'm afraid that in the process of hedging, he's going to actually set a trap for himself. And it's a trap that was that Trump bequeathed him, not literally, because Trump's not dead, you know, and I'm not even going to say what I'm thinking about that. But, you know, I think that, you know, this trap was left for him. I'm afraid he's going to keep the American military in the jaws, right, ready for that bear trap to potentially close, and then is going to feel obliged to respond, which could cause an escalation and more troops there. And, you know, the whole thing is just a big mess. There is nothing rational about the American presence in Iraq. And of course, there never really was. But it's even more absurd today.
Right. I think about that a lot, about, like, I have to think that there are people who get that, right? That are in positions and they understand, like, hey, us being there leads to the potential of escalation, which only makes things worse. And there has to be some people in some of the apparatus who are willing to push back against that. Now, what I want to know is why, like, who are the people that are pushing back against this narrative and who want us to continue this, and why? And, like, I feel like if we were able to get that message out to more folks as to understanding why, I think more people would be on the side of, okay, it's time for us to leave. But we never get that side from the official state apparatus, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, one thing I'll just add to that is that most of the people he picked, as much as I've like attacked, I mean, really lambasted his picks, like every one. I mean, I've really made a career of it of like for 2 months. But as bad as they are in terms of their military-industrial complex ties and their record as arsonists put in charge of the fire brigade on things like Syria, Libya, Yemen, I mean, every one of them, including now, finally, Joe Biden, these guys aren't bullish on the Iraq war. Every right. single one of these men and women would tell an interviewer and have that the Iraq invasion of 2003 was one of the great foreign policy disasters of American policy. That's the difference of when you get, and it's a real difference. I mean, it's not just at the margins. I mean, compared to, you know, some of the neocon like hawks that are in the Republican Party, you know, when you put the Democrats in charge, that the at least they're going to say Iraq was bad, even if they supported it at the time. But that is an irony, isn't it? That, you know, you've got these people in there who every one of them thinks the Iraq war was a mistake, but I'm not sure that any of the senior people, I can't speak to their mid-level staff, but I don't see any one of the senior people that he's appointed to the national security establishment who would then go so far as to say Iraq is the greatest strategic disaster, you know, in modern American history, but we kind of have to stay because ISIS, Iran, I don't know. We don't want to look weak, do we? I mean, that's how American policy is made. That's the philosophy.
Right. Ugh. That's just depressing. It's just so, it's so cowardly to just sit there and say, we know there's a problem, but we're not going to do anything about it because we don't want to appear a certain way. And I know that's all politics, but fuck, like these are like millions of people's lives on the line. And I would add, you know, you mentioned all the issues with it, but also like just the fact that like Iraq is important because if it's destabilized, like it's only going to worsen in the rest of the region. It's only going to make all the other problems in the whole region worse. And if we do nothing or we keep going along this weird path of like exiting American military presence and pushing the contractor, pushing the JSOC, pushing the more, you know, proxy forces, like we're, it's not, it's just going to lead us to have less and less, ability to do anything about it concretely.
Well, Henry, you were involved in, you know, the more overt version of the, you know, kind of security force assistance, training proxies, you know, when it was pretty overt. I mean by that, you know, when it was like direct tactical army units, especially MPs like yourself, you know, training the official army we were raising in Iraq. You know, how did that experience, I guess, you know, influence the way you think about whether or not, you know, training, advising, and assisting foreign forces constitutes, you know, combat or an intervention? Because you'll see, I think what you're going to see when it comes to Iraq and lots of other things is you'll see the Biden administration re-inject the quibbling language of the Obama years where everyone was arguing the semantics of what constitutes a boot on the ground and right. what constitutes a combat soldier, which like I love language and therefore I like to look to it. But I mean, that got pretty absurdist, and the Republicans weren't wrong when they started pointing that out. I mean, they were wrong because like everything that was in their hearts was black mostly and horrifying. But they weren't wrong. And I'm afraid we're going to go back to that. So I guess, Henry, what did your experience doing that influence the way you view this kind of stuff?
It does in a few different ways. There was always such a learning curve to everything that we did. And on learning curve, I'm not just talking about the Iraqis that we tried to train, but for us too, in terms of, you know, you bring with you, you know, just the platoon or squad, whatever you happen to have, and whatever training they have is what training they have. And it doesn't allow for, you know, the two or three guys possibly in your squad or platoon that absolutely hate Iraqis because they're on their second or third tour. So trying to train them in any kind of a comprehensive, unnerving way is just completely difficult. But the thing that I look back to, the thing that is most, one of the things that is most powerful to me, aside from stories, like hearing about the Iraqi, you know, battalions, them, their battalions and divisions folding before they even got into contact with ISIS. It's about that we don't even have enough understanding to understand the economics of bringing the equipment that we gave to the Iraqis, where, like, you know, and I've mentioned this quite a few times on the podcast, but, you know, Iraqi police recruits or officers, however you want to coin them, there often wasn't very much of a difference. The guys would go sell their Glock. They got issued a brand new Glock 19 pistol, you know, for police work. And they would go and sell it in the market. Why? Because they were super evil? No, it was because it was worth so much more than they had ever made over the course of 6 months or a year of wages, if not even longer. That was one of the big things that the protests, the ongoing protests are about, is the low wages or late wages, wages that are paid, you know, 9 months or 12 months later. And so it really required a lot of effort to take a specific amount of recruits and actually turn them into something that an American police officer would say, this person has some skills. You know, I don't understand Arabic or anything, but they know how to handcuff somebody and they know how to do this and do that. But as with our military machine, as each new unit would come and take over the jobs that I had there, everybody has a different idea of what is the best way to do it. Aside from the very basics, you know, the very basics in terms of using hand signals to do that kind of thing, we didn't have anything else to use to get across what was happening. But I think that we didn't even understand what it was doing to the local economics, to the local social and political scene. I remember being just freaking flabbergasted being told that a local prison that was near some of my operations area was entirely corrupt. It's like the entire working staff of this prison is corrupt. If you want somebody out, even if their sentence had already ended, they probably had to pay a bunch of money. And that was something that we never understood while we were there. We knew that there was quote-unquote corruption, but we didn't understand what we were looking at in the first place, and we didn't have any resources to fight that corruption either, because how do you do it when it's a somewhat working part of a place's culture? But no, it was at the end of the day, it was entirely for naught. You know, I don't think that we left much of an appreciable anything in terms of police force or army force that the Iraqis could use, that they could count on, which is why, you know, that the Kurds coming south to help and the fact that they actually expelled ISIS. I mean, ISIS isn't completely gone, but the fact that the Iraqis themselves did it mostly without American support, aside from some air support, I think that that's an impressive and huge thing. But it's out of survival. It's not because we did anything, we left anything there that was going to help the Iraqis in a major way.
No, I think that what's interesting about what you're saying there, and I think it relates to Africa a bit. And so, and we can pivot to that if you guys want, or we could hold it. But I'll say, like, what you raised there is a bit of nuance and complexity that's just so often missing in the discussions of this, because the host government and the political, ethnic, sociocultural, and, you know, just general, value and legitimacy of the host government and its military matters a whole lot in a security force assistance mission. And so, you know, I've been writing for example, about Africa again recently, because you know how I do. And like, it's, I think, pretty important, because one of the things I said in this last article was, you know, I titled it, this is at antiwar.com, ISIS Africa Alarmism brought to you context free by defense analysts, you know, by defense analysts. And what I say, the context that's missing, I say, you know, that these people, these analysts are interested in attack numbers and statistics. Sure. But, and then I write conflict context, local grievances and catalyzers, the counterproductivity of past Western military interventions. And then this is the key, or the tainted and dubiously legitimate regimes they usually back, not so much. And so, you know, the Iraqi military, you know, did do the lion's share of the fighting and put itself together, but they, of course, did fall apart, to, you know, when ISIS first comes through. But before that, and you probably remember this, I mean, units that we worked with and that we were, you know, whatever, advising and definitely partnering, that was the big term back then, right? Put an Iraqi between you and the problem. I was like, that's so patronizing. I don't even know what to do with it, but okay. But you know, and it was a great buzzword, but what was interesting about it was they were torturing prisoners. You know, my colonel sent a special patrol to seize the prisoners that we had earlier in the day handed over to the Iraqi National Police to save them from the torture that we got a tip that they were undergoing, and they were. And so it's just like, we throw military solutions and we throw things like advising and assisting and training and arming at these problems as though they're in as though they're solves, right? They're solutions in and of themselves. We pay very little attention to the host government. So you get the Maliki regime. One of the reasons that they fall apart in Mosul is Maliki had removed some of the most competent generals and officers and replaced them with, you know, political partisan loyalists from his own faction of the Shia faction, right? The faction within the faction. And then these were political generals, and they had ghost soldiers on their roles and all this, and corrupt. And I don't know, it just seems like we miss all of that. So when they throw a bunch of drone, contractor, commandos, advise and assist, special operators, they just throw it at the wall and see what sticks. And it's all done like an absence of context and without understanding that the well is poisoned from the start if you're doing it with corrupt proxies. And that just always just jumps out at me. And Africa, of course, is like the key element where I think we're seeing some of this.
Yeah. And you know, there was never any training or even acknowledgement of the idea that here we are arriving to a country that is, you know, is 30 to 40 years deep, if we can go back further historically, but that the 30 to 40 years deep in the choices and draconian measures of our imperialism there, which even if there were, you know, IPs that wanted to do a good job, that wanted to be part of it, I wouldn't blame any of them for having a natural distrust of anything that we did. Because it could just immediately be turned around so easily, and they had so little control over what that happened. You know, that changing out a commander, changing out a unit, going from army soldiers to Marines or back again. You know, coalition forces, meaning that sometimes Poland or some other countries might have some little small sector. There's so many irons in the fire. You have to pick one and completely detangle it before you can get to the next. And it just became that, you know, as we're picking back up the latest mess up, the latest fuck up. And we're going to work on that for a while, but it doesn't change anything. And that was where I was when I was on my second tour in Iraq, is that I knew we weren't changing anything. I knew we weren't going to substantially help the people of Iraq in some measurable way. I just wanted everybody to make home alive on both ends. And, you know, I didn't want to hurt anybody, and I didn't want any of our guys to get hurt. Those were the only things, only metrics that I could discernibly have any kind of control in. And that's immediately where I went to. So, Danny, if you want, we can go ahead and move over to Africa now.
Oh, I just wanted to say one thing.
Shoot, man.
I'm, you know how we have the like bootstraps myth of like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can make it regardless of the situation. I think that that applies in our military context as well, is that we can assume that we can go to a country and that they will just understand the way that like how to build a nation.
Yeah. See, right? It is goodwill. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't know we don't know a fucking thing about nation building because we've never actually had to do it. Like we've been so far removed from our own nation building that we have this idea that like, oh, if we just change these specific circumstances in this country, then they'll just get it somehow. And like, that is clearly not the case. Just like you said, like if we're not leading with the diplomatic arm of, hey, what do you need? Let's get you what you need. And then we can start from there. But instead, it's just, hey, we always tell people, hey, this is what you need, or we're going to do this in your country and you're going to like it. You know, and like, and then we get pissed off when it doesn't work. And it's like, well, of course it didn't work because we built this house on fucking sandpaper and it's not going to get anywhere. And I don't know. I just thought that was like, it's just that translation of into our military policy of our own weird economic policy of everybody just has to figure it out. And we'll just throw money and people at the problem until they do.
But eventually they'll realize we're here to help and it'll be okay. It'll be okay. Yeah, it'll be okay until you redeploy, which means it's now okay for you, but it sure as hell isn't okay for them.
Exactly. Oh, it's nonsensical. It's not really strategic thinking, and it has nothing to do with actually helping the people in the places that we send people to die. But yeah, let's move on to Africa.
So I didn't make any specific notes about Africa stuff. How do you guys wanna do that part?
I mean, I just wanted to bring up the fact that, like, you did hint at, Danny, the fact that there is a kind of similar situation. It's always again of like, we're not asking people what they need or what they want help with. We're just telling people, hey, look, we're going to do this in your country. And we might make some concessions with our agreements with them, but really it's about imposing our will. And so I am concerned about, you know, what are the different ways that you think this is going to play out in Africa? And on top of the fact that China with the Belt and Road Initiative is making real headway in Africa, and like how are our interests gonna really conflict?
Yeah, so there's so much to say there. I'm glad you brought up the China element. So okay, when I did the overview and covered the Africa section, the highlights that I wanted to hit, you know, I've done a few articles recently on it, and there's so many deep directions, you know, that I could get lost in. But, you know, Africa worries me with the Biden administration for the same reason it worried me and it escalated so intensely for the Obama administration. And that is because a few reasons. One, it figures pretty prominently in the minds of certain people at the Pentagon, certain people in the Capitol, and definitely in a lot of these like defense analysis expert and also influential think tanks, because specifically for interventionist hawks, particularly like the liberal internationalists, liberal interventionist types, Africa as a continent, as I write, has been both like a petri dish, a proving ground, and kind of this like paradigm. In other words, it's a petri dish for the problems that they think they can solve, like, you know, ungoverned spaces and, you know, climate change and poverty and, you know, all these ethnic like issues and, you know, potential genocides. And oh, my God, now like Sam Power is coming back into power and like she's going to be in charge of what, USAID? Like, Jesus, she's going to have like genocide watchers everywhere. Like she's going to arm her USAID people with rifles. And the thing is, it's not that genocide is not a real thing and that some of her academic work wasn't important, but the idea that intervention by the West is always the answer, especially when there's such a propensity to exaggerate and raise alarm about what's actually a genocide, right? But nevertheless, they see this as kind of, you know, so it's a petri dish for the problems, but it's a proving ground for the paradigm of the liberal polite interventionist, which is that you can use this abstraction, this low intensity tech savvy war of like drones, special operators, advisors, local proxies, and then clandestine intelligence missions. You know, you can use this to win wars and to like move policy and kind of, you know, change the facts on the ground. Now, it's failed time and again. It failed for 8 Obama years, and it failed even more mightily in many cases in 4 Trump years. However, they still believe it. So that's the first thing that bothers me. The second thing that worries me about Biden coming in is that the very things that he's most likely to be persuaded by, they all exist in Africa. So the first one is the stuff that I wrote about in antiwar.com this week, 2 days ago, which is that there's a lot of alarm raising coming from West Point, coming even from UK defense analysts, you know, organizations and defense studies departments in their, you know, military funded, otherwise, you know, masquerading as academia locales. Of course, in this case, it's defense, you know, spelled with a C because it's, you know, it's England. So it's more sophisticated. But nevertheless, you're seeing a lot of AFRICOM alarmism, like ISIS related, like, oh, ISIS is on the rise in Africa. And I deflate that pretty horribly and effectively, at least in the anti-war column. But it's something that I think he'll be susceptible to, this idea that, hey, ISIS is on the rise and ISIS is synonymous with evil. And so we might have to, like, you know, escalate a little bit, but it's great because it's Africa. So Africa doesn't even have a lot of soldiers. They don't have a lot of resources. They're like 1500, like permanently assigned people, you know, in uniform. So, hey, we'll test this theory a little more. But the really troubling one is what you brought up, which is China, Russia, because in the 2018 National Security Strategy, GPC, great power competition, right? Great buzzword, great acronym, has been made the primary threat, right? The primary strategy and focus of the U.S. military. Of course, that's ridiculous, and it inflates those threats, and it ends up being aggressive and counterproductive. But nevertheless, it's going to stick around, and especially with like all of the Russia, Putin proxy and sort of like stooge stuff about Trump that was thrown around. You know, the Democrats have made everything about Russia for so long, and they're both trying to out-hawk each other, the Democrats and Republicans, on China. And the fact that there's just enough of a kernel of truth to the fact that there's particularly Chinese influence, mostly economic, but there is one military base in Djibouti and I think another one coming, which is nothing compared to our, you know, kind of, you know, host of bases that have been exploding across Africa. But there's just enough truth that I'm afraid, and AFRICOM is savvy too, but they're PowerPoint savvy. They're really good at finding captains who write vaguely well, not for the earth, but for the military, to write these new strategies. And so what they've done to align and nest, right, all those like terms from the military to, you know, align their priorities with the broader national security statement, they've made their primary number one listed line of effort GPC, right? Great power competition. And they're going to point to particularly the Horn of Africa, because that's where China's one base is. And I'm afraid that we'll get pulled in there. And as for my predictions bit and how I've been a bit prescient recently, wouldn't you know that there was literally a headline, and I reposted on Twitter after someone else tagged me in it, that Emmanuel Macron of France, since their war in West Africa is falling apart, right? 5 French soldiers, KIA, in the first 5 days of, you know, the new year. And then maybe they hit it with another wedding, which is such a war on terror cliche, guys. You know, if you're going to massacre civilians, just don't do a wedding. You know, what about a christening? Why haven't we hit any christenings with our drones? You know what I mean? But I mean, I'm being wildly flippant dark here. But France's war is falling apart, failing by every single metric, every single one. And I said, hey, watch out. In my first article on Mali, I said, watch out. Be prepared that Macron and Biden could become chums. They kind of like each other despite the age gap. They both speak that like vague internationalist multilateral intervention language, right? They're sophisticates. They're urbane imperialists. But sure enough, there was a headline yesterday that in Macron's New Year's like talk to his troops, you know, it wasn't like on New Year's, I don't think, but he gave like this talk to the military. And he basically said like he's hoping Biden will basically help him out, you know, that Biden is going to have to infuse more troops, not just in Africa, but in the greater Middle East. And look, this is him asking for a bailout. He's the Goldman Sachs of failed African adventures asking for a bailout, right? And it's going to be like GM and all these people all over again. And he's probably going to give golden parachute bonuses to his failed generals. And it's going to be the same thing all over again. And I'm taking this analogy far, but I feel really good about it. But the point is, I'm really worried about Africa for all those reasons.
The guys and I love doing the podcast. Being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone, anyone whom you might think would be affected by it. Young people looking to join the military, or parents advocating for one, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment the military creates for minorities and inflicts on minorities across the globe, and anyone else you think it might affect, please take a moment and share this with them. Our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned right here as an honorary producer, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as a dollar a month, you can help keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I'm sure I can't think of at the moment. So let's bring out our honorary producers, and they are Will Arenz, Fahim Shirazi, James O'Barr, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Emma P., Janet Hansen, Tristan Oliver, Daniel Fleming, Michael Karen, Jason, Zach H., Ren Jacob, and the Status Quo Podcast. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/fortressonahill. Or please check out our awesome store on Spreadshirt.com for some great Fortress merch. The link is in the show notes. And now, let's get back to the podcast.
Do you think there's a way that we can, like, push the... Well, I'm hoping that there are people in the State Department who are finally like, okay, we need to stop being the military, the like diplomatic arm of the DOD, and start actually doing our fucking jobs. And I hope that that means that there will be people who will then like try to listen to what the countries in Africa want and like what they need. And then maybe like we can temper at least somewhat our like footprint militarily with some actual diplomatic like help. So I don't know, but well, I don't see that happening.
No. Well, you know, here's the thing. I think that there are FAOs, foreign area officers who like, you know, they kind of work with, I think they fall under DIA and they do work with state largely because they're in the embassies and all that. And then of course, within the recesses of Foggy Bottom, right? The actual mid-level experts who get, you know, like Milton, they get thrown into the basement and they get their red stapler taken from them. You know, there's plenty of professional bureaucrats, both in the military and especially in the State Department, who specialize their entire careers on Africa because they are geeks and because they love it. And in many cases, because they actually care about Africans to some extent. And they've been yelling about this, that like, hey, militarizing AFRICOM is a big mistake and this is like counterproductive. But that's the whole point. They get treated like Milton because the political appointees come in and the combat arms officers who actually run things like AFRICOM and make the decisions, right? And they have a lot in common in certain sense with the political appointees because they don't have expertise. They have leadership and charisma, meaning sociopathy largely. But the thing is, no one listens to the experts. And it has always been thus. And I study Africa a lot under the Reagan and even the tail end of the Carter administration and all our proxy wars during that era, usually surrounding supporting apartheid, by the way. And one of the things you note is that when you read these long ass books on it, they constantly quote the mid-level guys in the State Department who were like, no, this is a terrible idea. We're so opposed to this, but they don't get listened to. And I just don't think that Biden's political appointees really much care for nuance and complexity. And they are thinking big, and they take pride in their big thinking, and they don't like details, and they don't like splitting. What they like is lumping. But lumping problems together and vaguely generalizing and missing the nuance, that has always been a forever war formula. And nowhere has that been more tragic in many cases in the long run than in Africa since forever.
So for Yemen, just in the in the last couple of weeks, Mike Pompeo has been able to designate the Houthis as a terrorist organization, which until that designation changes, which incoming Biden execs are saying that they will review it. It wasn't saying specifically that it will be changed, but that will make it a lot harder for humanitarian aid to get in the country, which of course is exacerbating an already horrific situation. Our participation there, providing refueling and intelligence sharing, has allowed Saudi Arabia and their partners in Yemen with the UAE to continue bombing the hell out of anything that they can. It's still considered the world's largest cholera outbreak. And you know, my big thought about it is that, you know, why is this horribly, horribly awful humanitarian disaster, separate from the war part of it, not being dealt with on a bigger level? So I would hope and pray that Biden does a lot. I don't know that he will do a lot, but certainly they will probably have to do something, because the situation just has become that unhinged, that untenable on a humanitarian level. What do you think about that, Danny?
Well, first of all, I mean, the Trump decision to, you know, label the Houthis, like, you know, the terrorists, you know, it also is really about Iran, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, Yemen, in Iraq, we've put ourselves in the role of proxies. And don't get me wrong, like, we also create death and destruction for Iraqis as a, you know, as a function of that. But, you know, in Yemen is the great crime of the second half of the war on terror. And because its ramifications on victims have been so very overt and so very fast and so very quickly overt and so very quickly just been horrifying and specifically focused on civilians, I can't help but wonder if in the end it will be Yemen that is the stain, the ultimate primary stain on our entire generation of Americans. I mean, and it ought to be, by the way. It'll be competing with Iraq and the Civil War. But I mean, Yemen is another one of those places, just like I mentioned in Africa, where there is a substitution of vague generalities and strategic buzzwording and alarmist threats for nuance and complexity. I mean, there are some really smart people that Biden has appointed to top positions in terms of just their raw intelligence. Jake Sullivan is a brilliant guy, and he's probably one of the brightest of the bunch in terms of like what he knows, because he is a reader and he is a geek, you know. And I think that part of it, by the way, I have an obsession with him, as you know, he is my blind spot. You know, he's taking over Mike Pompeo's old role as my nemesis. But he, you know, I think that he maybe substitutes some of his like tough guy hawkishness for the fact that he's really a geek and he's afraid to just let himself be one. But that's probably his best side if he didn't use it for evil. But the thing is, even the smartest of the bunch on these issues, I mean, could not hold their own in a discussion on the basic contours of what's really happening in Yemen, what that conflict's really about on the ground. I mean, in terms of like Houthis and, you know, AQ in the, you know, Arabian ACAP. Peninsula. Yeah. ACAP, right. Yeah. Who you probably know a bunch about, I imagine. And I'd be interested to know your thoughts on Yemen specifically, actually, Kagan. you know, they don't understand this conflict. They can't explain it particularly well. And I mean, Jake Sullivan could probably make everyone else look stupid who doesn't know anything about Yemen. But I could name 10 people who could make him look very stupid on this issue. And of course, and this is the Biden bunch that's brighter than your average bears. But what gets missed in that lumping, in that vague generalities, is that the reality is the Houthis have never been all that tied to Iran, for example. And that the Houthis have never, despite yelling down with America and all those things, some of that is sloganeering because that was driven largely by America's obscene role in the greater Middle East and negative effects on the Shia peoples therein, and was really heightened when their children started getting bombed and starved to death inside the blockade. That could have only happened if America greenlighted and then supported it directly. And so that is a very different thing indeed than an actual intent to attack the homeland of the United States. And it certainly isn't if that did exist, believe that we caused it. If a Houthi, in fact, ever comes to the United States and blows something up or takes a shot at someone, it will be because of us in a very direct way. Look, most of these Houthis, most of that region in particular of Yemen, they didn't give the United States a whole ton of thought until certainly 9/11. So, and definitely more so since the Obama green light of the war in 2015. So that's my general thought on it. But Kagan, I bet you have some interesting stuff and thoughts on Yemen in particular.
Sorry, there was a motorcycle. Yes. Yeah. Like, I think the big thing, like, I think the thing that is hard for people to understand is the fact that Yemen was two countries until pretty recently. So there is a vast difference between the people in the north and the people in the south. And where the Houthis are, like, they are, first and foremost, they are nationalists or like tribalists. You know, they want their region of Yemen to be autonomous because the Yemeni government that came after their civil war was absolutely shitty and did nothing but try to exploit them. And so, of course, they were pissed off. And it's like, again, it's just historical context, you know, missing from a lot of our talk on foreign policy, which is something we talk about all the time. But I think it is really, like you said, to designate this group that is more about self-empowerment, like trying to create their own vision for themselves, as some kind of group that has these huge designs on like inflicting terror on the world. It's just nonsense and bullshit. And it does nothing but continue to exacerbate the fact that over 80% of the country in Yemen is dealing with serious hunger, serious disease, because not only do they have COVID, but cholera, as Henry talked about. And it's like, and also, I mean, you mentioned Iran, but like, it's also for Saudi Arabia. Like, we want to continue our buddy-buddy relationship with Saudi Arabia. And if that means continuing the richest country in the region's fight against the poorest country in the region, we're going to do that. Because people make that stupid political calculus of, well, we need to help the Saudis. And it's, it just pisses me off. Like, more examples of people not getting a voice because they don't have money and resources, so we don't listen to them. And on, like, I'm scared. Like, I am scared that the country is going to be in a serious, serious, I mean, they already are in a serious problem, but like, it's only going to get worse if we don't try to help them diplomatically and economically and medically. Like, medically first, they need help so bad. And yeah, I'm concerned. Like, they're sure ACAP has issues, but they also are in a specific, they are more in the south of Yemen, and maybe that's where we should be focusing more. But again, like, all of our military operations do nothing but exacerbate the problem. And when we continue to give aid to Saudi Arabia and the GCC, like, we're only helping those countries' interests. We're not helping the people on the ground.
Yeah, there's no way to talk about Yemen, of course, without talking about Saudi Arabia. And people look at Yemen through the lens, mistakenly, of Iran and Saudi Arabia's like big Cold War in the Persian Gulf and all that, which is often a hot war. But of course, Saudi Arabia has been attempting to and somewhat successfully dominating Yemen and invading and trying to lean on Yemen for the longest time. I mean, this is a very old thing. And the Saudis and the Egyptians fought a proxy and somewhat literal war there during the end of the Nasser, presidency in Egypt. So we're talking like after Suez, there was this big like intra-Arab proxy war between the more like national Arab nationalist, Marxist, vaguely socialist inflected Soviet bloc folks, and then like the U.S. backed theocrats in many cases, and different kind of autocrats. And so this has been playing out for a long time. Iran wasn't as involved in that at the time, except insofar that they would actually be on the American side, because this was the time of the Shah, when he was another one of our fun, dictatresses of the world that, John Quincy Adams otherwise mentioned in a different setting. So look, this is an old story, and I just don't think that there are even five above mid-level bureaucrats who could speak to any of that history in depth, and thereby, because they're not even interested in knowing it, certainly can't craft any sort of rational policy surrounding it. I mean, it's just such an important point. So what are we going to see in Yemen? I don't know. Maybe some minor curtailed arms sales to the Gulf states. Maybe a little less overt U.S. support. And I guess that's better. Maybe the Houthis will even come off the list. But is there going to be a paradigm shift? Is America going to do the ethically required thing, the decent thing, and shut that war down through threatening the Saudis with total expulsion from the Western bloc? And I just don't know what we really have to lose in that formula. In fact, if we did do it, what a great way to pitch normalization of relations with a much more important country, Iran. I mean, it's ridiculous that we would have to even think this way. That's like very much the nuclear option, and pun almost intended. But I just think this is really important.
No, yeah, I totally agree. And like, and think about how much that would go towards restoring our goodwill in the world. You know, if we are saying, hey, we are not supporting, like, in fact, we are making the moves to end this and help the people. Like, imagine how much better the world would think of us if we were to just completely reverse course.
There are so many opportunities for the United States to show like humility and decency and turn on a dime. And I mean, I would love to, I'm sure that I would just like give in and take the bribes to the military industrial complex and be a monster like all the rest of them. I mean, I have a price. It's just too high. And no one's offered it yet. I mean, I don't have any real ethics. No, but I like to think seriously that if you like put me in charge, I would just be like, on a number of issues, I would literally go in front of like the world, like just make a speech that gets, pitched everywhere, because I'm the American president, and be like, we have been monstrous war criminals and the orchestrators of chaos in, insert place here, in this case, Yemen. Mm-hmm. And we are profoundly sorry. And maybe I was even complicit before because I used to be a senator or whatever. But I'm totally pivoting, like radically so. And like, strap in, folks, because here's what's happening. Saudi Arabia is cancel cultured. Okay. Like, if Louis C.K. is gone, and I'm not saying what he did wasn't awful, like beheading sorcerers, yes, and adulterous women ought to get you canceled in, yes, the post Me Too era. Okay. And also starving babies. It's like, that's never cool. Me Too aside. And so like, there are so many places where like, hey, they're done. They don't ever get an arm for us again until they do the following 15 things, which they can't do, or their regime collapses because it's built on the theocracy and the dictatorship and the oil wealth. Like, so that's that, but there's so many opportunities for that. No one even thinks about it. And like, you might notice that was not in my predictions for the Biden team.
I think a lot of people gave Marianne Williamson crap, but like her idea of building a Department of Peace and what peace building actually looks like and like creating mechanisms for building and maintaining peace instead of war and instead of deterrence, you know, it's like, wow. I mean, come on, like think about how much safer we would actually be if we were dedicated towards building and maintaining peace instead of weapons. Fuck, like it's, yeah. And like, it's not like some vague notion of like, oh, kumbaya, let's all get along. It's like, here are specific strategic steps that that build peace. And we could do that. But yeah, I don't see this administration doing that at all. So what I was looking at is, you know, Obama had the Pacific pivot, which was the idea of we're going to move a lot of our forces and like our military strategic elements over to Westpac, you know, the whole Seventh Fleet area, basically. And then what Trump did was take that and Pompeo, they added India into that because they were thinking, oh, let's be buddy buddy with India. And we'll use them more as like a counterweight against China and Chinese aggression in like the South Asian area. So I am concerned that Biden is going to see the like bullshit political calculus of that and think that that is still a good thing. And I don't think that he's really going to do anything to like stop the things that have been put in motion. So, like, what do you think about that, Danny?
Yeah, I mean, throughout the campaign, they were trying to, like, the Democrats were trying to sort of, like, out-hawk the Republicans on China. For my sins, I read everything written in Foreign Affairs by people who were appointed by Biden, and it is a dark place. Don't do it. Just, like, I'll tell you what you need to know. Like, don't read it, okay? It's the only time in my life I'd encourage people not to read. I'm worried about it. I would like to think that you'll see less of the wild, just language of someone like Mike Pompeo saying like, Xi Jinping and his regime are Leninist, Marxist, and it's like, Mike, I know that you were valedictorian of West Point and all, because wait a minute, he'll tell you. Like, just wait for it, it's coming. But would you like to actually describe the varying like nuances of, you know, different elements of kind of Marxist and communist theory? Because like, do you even know what you're talking about when you call them like Marxist lines? Anyway, I'm hoping some of that won't be as bad. But then at the same time, it's like, you know, Biden said that she is like a thug or something. And there's just a lot of like troubling, although more polite, you know, fear-mongering and hawkish talk from some of his people in their written stuff. And then, geez, I mean, Michel Flournoy's article in Foreign Affairs, which I think was titled something like Avoiding War with China, but all it talks about is how to win and wage a war with China, and that we have to be prepared to sink their entire, not just naval fleet, but merchant fleet in, what'd she say, 48 to 72 hours?
Yeah, something ridiculous like that, yeah.
That's crazy talk. That's cuckoo. You should be canceled for stupid. Like, I don't understand how you even get to be a serious figure, have a job. Like, there's gotta be garbage man positions. Nothing wrong with garbage man. That's actually more honest work than colluding with the UAE at your think tank on behalf of the U.S. government and making a killing out of it. So I'm not even insulting garbage man, but like, she shouldn't be allowed to be even in a job anymore after talking about that. Certainly not a job where she can make a difference in like whether we kill or not. But I mean, this is scary. And I mean, that's a tinderbox. I mean, the South China Sea, you know, I talk about my subtitle is something like the threat of like, you know, ramming into trouble with China. And it's like literal, though, like actual, that could happen, like ramming of ships and stuff. Look, the South China Sea has China in it. And that doesn't mean that we just have to like cede everything to China or say it's okay for them to do everything they do. I mean, most of the people that they're contesting those islands with in the South China Sea are other Asian countries, you know, I mean, in the region, because, you know, we're kind of far away. I used to be really into maps as a kid, and I know they're not always to scale, but 8 inches on a small map is a lot of space, you know. And it, look, it, this is crazy. The idea that we're in some sort of Thucydides trap, whereby a rising power and the existing power like inevitably end up at war. That's not always true, but it often is. There's a reason it gets a name. And if it's a Greek title to the name, it's probably old and it probably has some truth to it. And if it doesn't, we'll probably have to make it true just to satisfy, you know, just to satisfy the trope. But I'm really worried about that because it's so unnecessary. Economic competitors, even strategic competitors in some security realm, the idea that that should risk massive war is just insane. And I keep like kind of going back to like, how long are delusions in Asia have gone on, you know? And it's a real thing. We've had these fantasies that somehow that's the Western Pacific, it should be some sort of American lake, and that Asian trade, the open door policy, we're talking like 1800s here, like late 1800s, you know, this is an old delusion that never really pans out. It actually caused the world war in the Pacific with Japan, right? I'm not like taking Japan completely off the hook for its own militarism, but like a lot of that was driven by this. And so no one really talks about that. And I think when it comes to China, the last word one ultimately has to give to the movie The Princess Bride. And so I'd recommend that, you know, Joe Biden and look, some of the hipsters on his staff who we all know ironically like cult classic 80 movies, go back and watch The Princess Bride. I believe it's 1987, where they're sitting there talking as they like, you know, have their like intellectual duel over who drinks the poison, you know, and I forget his name, but the guy says to the main character, he says, you know, you're a fool. You fell victim to one of the classic blunders, the most famous of which is never get involved in a land war in Asia, you know, and like that should be the final word. So listen, for all you cult classic late 30s, early 40s somethings who really like bars in Brooklyn where you can talk about, you know, whatever your new appointed job is in the cool administration or the think tank that you got and who you met within the Obama administration, just watch that movie and let's avoid a land war in Asia. And Michelle, I don't even know if you watch movies or if like robots are allowed to, but if you do, you should consider it too. And Sea Wars, those aren't really all that much better, because the first time a naval ship goes to the bottom of the ocean and 600 sailors die in a single incident, I will tell you, America has not seen anything like that in a really long time, and our people are not ready for it. And it only takes one A2AD missile, and it could very, very much happen.
No, we've never seen that kind of immense scale destruction for 70, 80 years now. People would just be losing their minds much more than they do even now with just cancel culture.
I agree with you. Like, we are reaching that inflection point where a power on the decline and there's a power on the rise. And we really have some existential crises facing us. We have to decide what's important. Like, are we going to focus our attention on the fact that the planet doesn't have very long to live, or are we going to continue to focus on, you know, our stupid power struggles with other countries that finally want to get a taste of what we've had for the last 100 fucking years? And yeah, sure, like China is being aggressive, but they're just wanting to get on the train that we've been on. Like, they just want to join. It's just like what we did when we started the whole Spanish-American War bullshit of us trying to get into imperialism. It's like, oh, we want to get in on that game. Like, let's do what the other European countries are doing. And like, China is just wanting a taste of what we've had, you know. And I'm not excusing it. I'm just trying to understand the reasoning behind it. And we need to figure out, do we want to approach that from a military standpoint and say we need to figure out how to beat them so that we can, again, be a deterrent for them? Or are we going to try and figure out a way that we can coexist and accomplish our goals together? And we just don't seem to care about that. And I don't see that that is really getting any better unless something tragic happens.
These days, making a deal with China usually just means decent economic incentives for their involvement. We bring a whole slew of death and destruction, and I'm sure that there's not that there aren't people that get hurt through that, but it's nothing compared to what us and our proxy, what Americans and their proxies end up doing in those same situations.
I think that when we talk China, you know, and for the sake of time, I'm gonna breeze over Russia, except to say that Russia does not deserve breezing over in any real sense. But we've talked about it in some past pods, and the real threat, as I see it, ultimately to mankind, right, beyond just America, is that in our attempts to be tough on Russia in, you know, say the Baltic, as some sort of like pivot away from the idea that Trump was like a straight up asset of Putin, which is ridiculous. I mean, you know, there's smoke and there's problems with Trump and Russia, but like Trump was wildly aggressive, provocative, and nuclear saber rattling, especially towards the end of his time, you know, in with Russia. Okay. Uh-huh. So that's a weird way for, you know, a useful idiot to act, unless he's playing the real long game and he's fooled us all. But the guy ain't that brilliant, and he can't keep a secret, and he would totally brag about, I'm so smart that I started to be hard on Russia and you didn't even notice it because I'm smarter than you think I am. And it's like, dude, you just gave it away. You're here, you're yourself speaking. It's like, no, but I have to say something great about myself. Like, there's no such thing as humble bragging to Trump, because that requires the humble part of the humble brag, which, anyway, but the point is, you know, he was tough on Russia. I'm afraid the Democrats are going to double down on that. And then I'm afraid that they're going to out hawk on China. And if they do, it'll be partly because of the toughness dilemma, the Democrats' dilemma of toughness. And it'll also be partly because their idea of like free trade, neoliberalism, TPP, which is a whole other topic, and it's complex and it's not just evil, but this idea that, you know, Democrats are a little more concerned with like slight nuance, where they'll actually talk about soft power and they'll talk about like economic competition. But even the Democrats, the establishment ones, they tend to equate economic competition and apply their competing, right, the tools they use to compete, they usually do a very militarized version. And so I'm really worried that we're always one mistake from the extinction of humanity in an afternoon. And we're not scared enough of that. And that sounds like really hyperbolic until you really look at what people who know this policy, whistleblowers and people who are experts on nuclear policy, what they say about all this and how much of a near run it's thing always a near run thing it's always been. And, you know, wouldn't that be the ultimate kick in like the democracy's, you know, what's if it's the Democrats who like somehow end up doing something much worse than a monster like Trump, because they like overcorrected and just did what they do and worried about toughness too much. And that's like kind of my last word on Russia too, which I think, you know, draw a circle around Russia and put like a red pin in every place that touches them, and like expect to see an escalation of US influence there in some nefarious and largely aggressive way. And that's not a compliment to Putin, and it's not an endorsement of anything he's about. It's just, that's how we do. We surround countries like Russia, and then we say, why are you so close to us? Back off. Yeah. Back off. It's like, have you ever looked at a map of like NATO nuclear bases? Like, wait a second, who's surrounding who, kiddos? Or those maps of Iran? It's the same thing. Anyway, enough about that. Yeah. But that, I think that's the key point, and or one of them.
Well, what do you think that we can do as regular people to like try to put, like, if we're saying that the things that we care about are diplomacy, like if we're gonna say that we want some kind of intervention, you know, that it has to be specific and short term and abbreviated and to the point, then like, I feel like there has to be a way for regular folks to be pushing for that. Like, because if we don't as regular people take a stand against this and say more militarism is the last thing we need. We need X, Y, and Z. Like, I think that we know that the powers that be and the people who are invested in this are going to keep doing that. And they're going to keep pushing the reasons why. And So we need to have a collective like voice and a collective point to refute that with. And what do you think that is?
You know, street activism and grassroots stuff is sometimes poo-pooed when it comes to its ability to influence foreign policy.
Right.
And there's more than a kernel of truth in that. I mean, the U.S. government rarely is particularly responsive to its citizenry on foreign policy issues, especially. They don't really have to be. Much of the policy has always and is especially now made unilaterally in the White House or certainly in the executive branch. But there are examples, and that's not always the case, right? So there's been some interesting like academic work done and you know, policy and history work done on like the nuclear freeze movement, right? And we're talking particularly in like the late 70s or early 80s. I mean, look, anytime you get Simon and Garfunkel to reunite after like a tragic and heartbreaking 7-year breakup of the greatest duo of Queens, New York boys to get together and make a folk sound that makes everyone's life better just because it exists. And you get them to reunite for a concert for the nuclear freeze movement in like 1980. And it becomes a live album that changes a kid in Staten Island's life. I don't know who. When that happens, that's something big. And I'm purposely fooling around. But there's been a lot of work showing that, look, there was a pretty mass movement and it was global. It wasn't just American, you know, calling out the hair trigger nuclear situation between the Soviet Union, particularly, and the United States. And it really did pick up steam in like the late Brezhnev era. So like late 70s. And look, that's not the thing, right? There's very rarely singular solutions or singular explanations. That's probably not the thing that gets Reagan to think a little more sensibly when Gorbachev comes to power and start to make some really solid moves. But it had an effect, and it had an effect on the Democratic Party also. I mean, it did have an effect on the way some of the, you know, congressional representatives and even some of the senators thought about all this. And what worries me today is the casual, offhanded way Americans don't even speak as much as they ought to about things like nuclear warfare, and then, you know, even conventional warfare against a major power. Like, we're not scared enough of it. I don't know tactically, movement wise, because I'm not great at solutions and strategizing in that world. Like, I'm new to it and I'm learning more than I'm prescribing. But I do think that somehow, some way, the citizenry needs to be more scared. I hate to say that, but scared about the right things instead of the drummed up fears that we're told to be scared of. You know, it's more likely that dropping a couch on your own head is going to kill you than a foreign-born terrorist, but we're scared to death of foreign-born terrorists, you know? But there are things we should be scared of that we're not scared enough about. And then I hope that's not the only reason people do it. I hope it's all like decency and strategy and intellectual stuff and just general ethics. But we need the people to get involved because it has had effects before. And Biden is responsive sort of to pressure politically, and the Democrats will do like America, like Winston Churchill said about America, the Democrats will do the right thing every time after they've exhausted all the other options, basically, after they've done all the wrong things first. And so, but when they're pressured, when they have no other choice, and I just hope that we can see grassroots citizen involvement on this issue, Russia, China, but on every issue, because I do not believe that Biden and his unilaterally picked and sometimes not even requiring Senate sanction appointees, I mean, they're not going to shift any paradigms or transform anything unless they're pressured to do so. And that's going to have to come from the people.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill and also at facebook.com/FortressOnAHill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify. You name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
And listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not be